Mr. Pat Tyler, Real One. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Tyler?
Well, I was born in London, 1923, 20th of January, and my parents at that time lived in Albert Bridge Road.
And could you tell us a little about your family background?
Well, my mother was a Yorkshire woman who had been married before to lieutenants in the York and Lancaster Regiment, who was killed on the 1st of July on the Somme, 1916. She was a very unusual woman in that she herself went out to France in about 1917, doing in charge of girls packing artillery shells and base depots and things, and she was eventually commissioned into what was then known as the Queen Alexander's Auxiliary Army Corps in 1918. My father was a post office administrator who'd been on the Northwest Frontier in the Afghanistan War, came back to England in 1920, I think. They were married in 1921, and I arrived shortly afterwards.
What do you remember of your early childhood in London, this part?
Right, in London itself, all I can remember is the family next door and three children, but they had a most amazing steam engine, which you could get. It would actually go by lighting things and it would run, but I moved out, you see, with my parents in 1926 to Welwyn Garden City, which was a rather lovely place to go, and I had a very enjoyable childhood there.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
No, only child.
And what about your first school? What was that?
Well, primary, I was very lucky because my primary school at St Albans was immediately behind my house. I had to walk quite a long way, but no roads to cross. My recollection of school is country dancing, and later on, towards the end of the primary school, I remember being sent into a classroom in a wood, I think an artificially built classroom, and there was a girl there who was very good at writing. And she and I used to spend most of our time writing things, and the teachers didn't seem to bother us very much. At the age of nine, I went on to St Albans School, which is a sort of cross between a public school and a grammar school, where I enjoyed working and seemed to settle into the activities fairly happily.
Was any subject that you particularly excelled in?
Well, because of her French background, my mother got me a tutor in French when I was six. I was only for one term, but it did give me the feeling that I knew a bit more than most. And she sent me over to France when I was 10, and I think again when I was 14. And in the French oral exam what was then called an O-level, I got 96%, but I was very bad at French grammar, so the oral cancelled out the grammar.
What about other subjects? Anything else?
Very, very fond of history. Very fond of history. Also very fond of physics, but of course in the system of those days, I went into the sixth form at 14, and you then had to decide whether you arts or science. So I never did any other science at all until much later at Signals Option. I found myself back with wireless theory, which was a bit of a strain.
What about sport? Any interest in that?
Yes. Keen rugger player. Very keen rugger player. Not much use at cricket, but I broke my arm, which was turned out to be very important because this meant I was out of cricket for a season. When I came back, everybody had forgotten I existed. So I decided to take up golf. They just opened a brand new golf course in St Albans. And that became a great passion of mine, leading to me playing in the British Boys Championship in 1938 and 1939, and later on playing for Cambridge.
So that was your main game, golf?
It was.
Now, what about at school? You were in the OTC from 1937 to 41. What made you decide to join the OTC?
Well, broadly speaking, everybody was in it. It wasn't sort of very much of an either-or. I wouldn't go so far as saying it was compulsory, but as far as I was concerned, everybody was in it. And I was very keen. I won the recruit's medal in my first term, would you believe it?
Now, how was the OTC organised at the St Albans School?
Well, I suppose it was basically, funnily enough, it was rather organised round a book by the chap who became General Montgomery. He was then, of course, Major Montgomery, or he'd written the great book called Infantry Section Leading. And I think you'll find that all OTCs were really training infantry sections, infantry companies, never got really bigger than that. Of course, sometimes you'd be sent off to OTC camp, where you'd meet other units, you'd march for military bands and that sort of thing.
What sort of actual training did you do at the school then? Can you take us through some of the things you did?
Well, of course, we had an armoury, everybody had a rifle, you'd do all the drills, and but much more interesting, of course, was when you went out, you know, to try to learn a bit about how to organise troops on the ground, only on a very small level, company attacks and that sort of thing. You'd go out on the firing range, you'd go out on exercises. And, of course, during the war, you see, so many activities were sort of cancelled, school clubs and debating societies and all that stuff. So that as I became a non-commissioned officer in this OTC thing, I found myself lecturing on all these things. And to me, it was a kind of substitute for the kind of club societies and things that I would normally have been involved in peacetime. I became the number two in the OTC, I suppose, who's the CQMS, and my best friend was the CSM.
And you took your certificate A and B?
Yes, I think that was a bit unusual. So this certificate B thing is a fairly rare bird, if I remember rightly. It's a sort of A-level thing for the army exam, yes.
What exactly did it entail? I mean,
well, it, of course, this was written, these were written exams. Certificate B was an entirely written exam, and it was basically having a mastery of everything that Major Montgomery had been trying to teach. That's really what it was all about. And you've got to know about army organisation, army structures, and all that sort of thing.
Now, putting that aside for a bit, another thing, at home, your mother was very involved in the co-op. Could you tell us a bit about that? Because this is the other strand of your life we're going to look at, your connection with the Labour Party and the co-op.
It's true. I mean, at St Albans, I mean, she had come from the north of England, where the co-op was a great means of getting cheap food and household necessities for the working classes. Perhaps I should have explained that my mother's father was a miner, although a rather classy sort of miner, in that he was the chap who was in charge of winding the chaps up and down in the cage to the bottom of the pit. And that's supposed to be the most responsible job on the pit, in the pit, and probably the highest paid. But belonging to the co-op, being a part of their life up there, and so we belong to the co-op in St Albans, and I personally didn't do much shopping in the co-op. In those days we used to go to school on Saturday mornings, and I used to stop off in the market at St Albans and buy the family's supply of fruit for the next week. It happened by a small off chance to be next to Tesco's, which was then one of the first two Tesco's that was ever set up. North London, Cheshunt, I think, was their first one, St Albans, I think, was their second. So that was my contact with shopping. But I didn't join the co-op until after I was 16, when, by which time, the family had moved to Manchester, because my father was in the post office regional headquarters, who had moved to Manchester at the beginning of the war. And he spent his time trying to put things back together again after the German bombing that disrupted all the telephones and telegraph things in that Manchester and Liverpool. So he had a very busy time.
Now, this was a somewhat complicated. Do you remember the day war broke out?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I listened to Neville Chamberlain's broadcast. And you may remember that the extraordinary thing was that about 10 minutes after he finished his broadcast, an air raid siren went off. And so we were all sort of expecting bombs to start falling immediately. But I never knew why. I never ever heard that any aeroplanes were actually seen. So what happened, I don't know.
Was there any panic?
No, I don't think it was. I don't think it was any panic. There was an awful lot of interest in the school, and one of our old boys, squadron leader K.C. Doran, dropped the first bombs on Germany after the war broke out, I believe, near a place called Heligoland on the German North Sea border. But, I mean, he came to the school and we were all a bit interested that he had been dropping the first bombs on Germany after the war. But we then had another school, what do you call it, they came out from the middle of town, lived with us.
Evacuated.
And look, we used to have to man, we had a home guard unit, we used to man the armoury at night. And I seem to remember one occasion when I was dismounting the guard, and you know, we had the rifles at the port, and we were going up and down with the old, what's the name of the thing? Bolt. Closed bolt, squeeze trigger, my gun went off. But of course, it only had a blanket, so it didn't do any harm, but it was a bit of a shock all the same. A bit of a shock.
Now, how did the outbreak of war affect your life? Now, because your family moved to Manchester, you said. Can you just explain what was going on? You stayed in St Albans or Wellingarn City. What exactly happened?
Yes, well, that's absolutely right. My parents, my father was sent, because they regionalised the post office, my father was sent up to the northwestern region. And there was a lot of debate as to whether I should move schools. But I'd just done my A-levels. I'd been in the sixth form for 2 years already. And I was then going to try and get scholarships to Oxford or Cambridge if I could. And we decided that I would stay in the present school. I went and lived with two of the masters at the school during the time that I stayed down. And one of them, I remember, was a North countryman who wasn't into this OTC business, and he and his wife seemed to be rather horrified at the amount of energy I spent in polishing my kit. All that sort of thing seemed very strange to them. But I'd kind of grown up with it. And so there it was. I was down in St Albans during term time, went up to Manchester in the holidays, and as you reminded me, it was there again we would join the co-op. South, I think it was simply called the Stockport Cooperative Society, I think. And that really led to me joining the local constituency Labour Party.
Now, had you had any political sympathies before you joined the co-op, or was it a family thing, or how did it develop?
Well, as a family, we took the Daily Mail, so we can't blame the national newspapers very much. On the other hand, I'd seen a lot of what was going on in the north of England and conditions of worked was I had an aunt in Dewsbury, in Yorkshire. I used to stay with her a lot. And I formed the impression that kind of society that was being built wasn't one that offered a fair deal to the working classes. And I felt there's got to be some significant improvements in this. And it seemed to me that the Labour Party was, although it had been in a bit of a mess 5 years previously, was getting itself organised, and I was particularly impressed, I think as many people were, with the performance of the Labour leaders in the War Cabinet. I haven't the slightest doubt that the fact that the Labour leaders were in the War Cabinet, particularly Herbert Morrison, Claire Attlee, Ernie Bevin, Hugh Dalton, they all seem to have been performing very competently as ministers, and this seemed to me to be a very important extra feature. Labour had always had interesting policies, but one wondered whether how the people in running the party would be able to run government. The war gave this excellent opportunity to give them a chance to do it. And particularly during the last 2 years I was in London, I used to go up to the Houses of Parliament and listen to debates and things like that. And when I got to Cambridge, I was even more involved because I became the secretary of the Cambridge University Labour Club. In my first year, I spent 1 year between leaving school and going into the army because.
I'll come. Hang on a moment. Now, so you joined. You joined the Labour Party in Manchester during your holidays, essentially. And that was the Stockport. Was that Stockport?
Well, this would be the constituency of Altrincham, but the ward would be probably called Sale or possibly Timperley. And what I do remember is that the secretary of the local ward, a gentleman called Tyrrell, T-Y-R-E-L-L, was particularly encouraging to me and helped me a great deal to understand what was going on, and because obviously the activities of local wards were something I hadn't been involved with before. And nor was I much involved with them then because I was only there in school holidays.
Now, so the Labour Party was organised into the constituencies and then into wards, which would be the local councillors' wards.
Well, I don't think we had many seats on the local council, but they would, as you say, the ward structure would be the council structure. This secretary of the local council was particularly welcoming to me and very helpful.
And did you attend, what sort of activities did the Sale or Timperley ward have at that time? How did it operate? Or were you not there long enough to see much of it?
I didn't see a lot of it. I mean, they were interested in the war, of course, and they were very difficult to give you much detail as to what I was there so little.
Did you have a theoretical attraction towards socialism? I mean, did you read Marxist theory or theoretical things like that? Or was it more a gut instinct backed up with a liking for contemporary politicians?
Well, it was more, I think, about the concept of fairness. I was, in a sense, I just had the feeling that the basic social system and economic system was in many cases unfair to the working classes. But I wasn't involved with Marxism at that time. I was involved with Christianity. So you could describe me, if you like, as a Christian socialist. I was very interested in Sir Richard Ackland, because you may remember in the days of the political truce, there was no great campaigning going on by Labour against the Conservatives because they were both partners in the coalition government. So campaigning tended to have to go on through
This organisation was called Commonwealth, and Sir Richard Ackland was its leader. So that where a serious opposition from Labour was going to be mounted against, in a seat which had been Conservative at the time of the death of the chap who vacated it, then the political fight had to be in the name of Commonwealth and could not be in the name of Labour Party. That, for instance, was how Tom Blackburn won his seat, Malden, Essex, as a Commonwealth candidate. And when I eventually came to fight the 1945 election, I actually had a Commonwealth candidate against me, but that's...
Did you actually get involved in any of these by-elections at that in the early part of the war? For Commonwealth
No, I don't remember campaigning in an individual by-election.
I think that you didn't do much, as you said, while you were on holiday in the Stockport area. So that's where you joined.
Yes.
Now, what about in... You were still going to school in St Albans. Did your new political allegiances affect anything at school or your attitude to the OTC or anything when you were back in?
I don't think so. I mean, as far as I was concerned, the Labour Party was 100% involved in the war. Our cabinet ministers were a very effective lot. Whereas, as far as I was concerned, on the Conservative side, once you'd said Churchill and Eden, the Labour cabinet ministers, war cabinet ministers, were almost a more effective group than the Conservatives. So in no way did I see any conflict between being Labour and supporting of the war and being involved in the OTC and all that sort of thing.
How did your schoolmates and, in fact, the schoolmasters you were staying, how did they react to your political allegiances? Or was it common?
There wasn't so much overt in the sense that my political activity was in Manchester and my school was in the south, but broadly speaking, I would have thought quite a few of the masters would be left-wing sympathisers, particularly the history master, and history was my real obsession, although I got... This is very interesting. I had a very, very efficient English master, and he taught me so well that I finished up getting an open scholarship in English literature, although really history was my real interest and probably led me down a bit of a side path. But I felt if I could get an open scholarship to Cambridge, that's what I'd better do.
So you didn't take part, you didn't join the St Albans or Labour Party?
No, I had no contact with the Labour Party in St Albans.
But you did go down to the House of Commons. Was that during that phase?
Well, it was more, I think, just an adventure to go and see it. I was much more involved, of course, once I got to Cambridge. But that's
right.
The later part of the story.
Now... What about just preparation? You told off tape, but could you tell a story about how you built an air raid shelter? Because that's quite...
Well, you see, I was deeply worried about Munich. You know, I couldn't regard this as any proper resolution of the problems of Europe, and I could see war coming. So I decided the right thing to do was to build an air raid shelter for my family, mother and father. And this I did with the aid of some convenient railway sleepers. I was very proud of it. But of course, when the German bombers came over, which was not so much in 39 but in 40, what we found is there was 2 feet of water in this blinking air raid shelter. So we tended to be, if I was at home rather than at school, we would be sheltering underneath the stairs, that mother and I, father's job would be to try to organise the restoring of all the broken communications in the area, Manchester and Liverpool, during the bombing. So he was out a good deal trying to sort that out.
Now, What about any other effects? Another thing you mentioned, I'll say, was at school. One of the more melancholy things you had to do was to. You were involved in the school magazine. Can you tell us about that?
I was editor of the school magazine, certainly in my last year, which would be 1940 to 1941. And this meant keeping very up to date with casualty lists. And this was a fairly gloomy job, but it did emerge that the distribution of casualties was very far from being even between the services. I had a very favourite housemaster who was killed as a fighter pilot very shortly after he went into active service. And the casualty risks for the RAF chaps were horrendously greater than for people in the army. Of course, at that stage, I suppose the army had come out of Dunkirk, and I and my senior NCOs of the OTC had been involved in unloading trains with wounded in after Dunkirk, being brought to local hospitals, so we'd had a look at the nasty side of that. But there wasn't much, of course, actual fighting going on. Once the troops had come back from Dunkirk, there wasn't a great deal of fighting going on, although, of course, things were being overrun in the Far East. Well, I did, whether it was then or later on, I was in the House of Commons the day that Churchill announced the loss of the Hood and the Repulse. And it was a wonderful parliamentary moment because Churchill looked a bit like death. He limped in Brendan Bracken's arm, and eventually made the statement in rather somber terms. But we did have one communist MP called Willie Gallagher, and he jumped up as soon as Churchill sat down and had explained it all. So, who's that's all very well, he said, but who's going to get the sack? I'm afraid the House of Commons burst into gales of laughter, even on what a very sad occasion. But I was very fond of the atmosphere of the House of Commons, as you can imagine. You did feel that you were there in the middle of it all.
Now, what about your whole... should have asked you perhaps before. How did you feel about Nazi Germany and Hitler and such? Did you understand what was going on there? Did you realise the scale of the threat or actually how bad it was at the time? I mean, obviously, perhaps since, but...
Well, once, of course, they had started invading... obviously too young to have been involved in the Rhineland business. We got, I suppose, first of all, he goes into Austria. That didn't look good. Then he goes into Czechoslovakia. That was pretty horrific. And I was certainly utterly convinced that Hitler was a wholly evil intentions in terms of taking everybody over. I was certainly not one of these people who felt that he made the trains run on time and cleaned the place up and to that extent, although we were Daily Mail readers, if that in any way represented a Daily Mail point of view, it certainly wasn't my point of view. They worried me enormously. And very, very pleased, of course, when Churchill took over from Neville Chamberlain, because we all believed that he was likely to be a much more effective wartime leader. Although, of course, I was also interested in the cases made against Churchill, particularly by Sir Richard Stokes, on the issue of the quality of our tanks, because Stokes and others were very worried that we were... Our tanks had 2-inch or 3-inch guns at a time, as the Germans were twice as big. And the fact that one, if supported Mr. Churchill, didn't mean that you agreed.